Well, thanks, Ruth, for that, and thank you all for the invitation to be here. It's a huge privilege to be with you. I'm sorry I've not been able to journey with you for the whole conference. When Ruth first approached me about this, I was already booked to be in Texas last week, and kind of felt that I needed to see my family and just check what was happening at work before leaving home again. So my apologies for that, but it's good to be with you for these few minutes at least. My name is Steve Holmes. I'm a Baptist minister. I came to study of theology through training for ministry, and although most of my life I've been paid to be an academic, first in King's College London, now in St Andrews there for the last 12 years now, that still shapes the way I try to approach the subject, and part of that has been to be involved with various formal groups, particularly these days through the Baptist World Alliance, and some formal ecumenical work there. And what I want to say to you comes a bit out of those reflections. And I particularly want to talk about baptism. You may have guessed from the title, it's, of course, for most churches, a core practice, and is a pressing issue, perhaps particularly for those of us who are Baptists, in interchurch dialogue. you can tell something's become culturally central when it becomes part of our humour. Because of the centrality of baptism, disputes over it become serious and painful for us. As I say, I've been involved with a couple of formal bilateral ecumenical conversations nationally a few years ago between the Baptist Union of Great Britain and the Church of England, and at present internationally with the Baptist World Alliance talking to the World Methodist Council. The next round of that in mid-February, they're taking us all to a place called Paradise Bay in Jamaica, suffering once again for the sake of the gospel. And one becomes acutely aware as a Baptist participant in those dialogues that we are out of step with mainline church opinion on these questions. And I have to tell you that we are out of step. This, you may know, is the baptismal font at the Roman Catholic Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption in San Francisco. We happened to be out there about 3 years ago. I was giving some talks at a seminary, and because it was San Francisco, we made a family holiday out of it. And it happened that our hotel was just around the corner from the cathedral, so the last morning when we returned the hire car and things like that, before we got the taxi to the airport, we went to look around the San Francisco. We went to look around the cathedral, and we were shown bits of it by a very enthusiastic verger who was very proud of this font and apparently thought we ought to have heard of the architect who had designed it, although I confess I haven't. We have three young daughters who listened very politely and said thank you after this verger had done her spiel. And then when she was a safe distance off, my 13-year-old turned to me and said, "So what is that big drinking fountain thing?" We have introduced an ecumenical strand to the church youth group curriculum since then. as Baptists, we are out of step. And I want to talk to you a bit about navigating that in ecumenical context. And I am speaking as a Baptist, and that's going to colour that. But I think there are things in two stories I'm going to tell you that are relevant much wider than just our own particular denominational conversations. There's an older tradition of trying to deal with this from the Baptist side, which is pragmatic but unhelpful, but that mirrors, I think, a lot of what we see happening in kind of informal grassroots ecumenism today. And a newer move that we borrowed from a Catholic Orthodox bilateral dialogue, which I think may be more interesting and more useful. And so I'll start with the one and then move on to the other. This is the famous Bunyan window at the meeting house in Bedford. You may remember the story of Terry Waite being sent a postcard of this whilst in captivity, and somehow it got through. Bunyan pastored back in the 17th century a mixed congregation. Some were Baptists, some were what were then called independents, what we probably now call Congregationalists, who held to a similar practice of church government, but who baptised their children as they were born. He was criticised for this quite sharply from both sides, and responded in a book. It's far less famous than The Pilgrim's Progress, justly so. but it was entitled Difference in Judgment About Water Baptism, No Bar to Communion. He made there an argument that has been repeated regularly by British Baptists down the centuries. An argument essentially that baptism is a secondary matter, that what matters really is faith and true discipleship. We cope with disagreement over baptism by insisting that actually it doesn't matter very much. Now that's been pretty normal for British Baptists down through our history, because our history has actually been ecumenical, more or less from the start, beginning in the ferment in the middle of the 17th century. We enter into quite quickly an experience of shared persecution with the other three churches after the restoration of the monarchy, and that of course brings people together. And then not long after that, the influence of the evangelical revival means that we're again making common cause with people who practice infant baptism, and indeed with people back then, Quakers particularly, who have no practice of baptism at all. Then into the 19th century, of course, with the rise of the Salvation Army, again there's a shared evangelical commitment with people whose practice of baptism is very different from ours. And so all through this time there's been this tension of working with people who you disagree with about this, and coping with it by saying, well, baptism doesn't really matter. What really matters is faith. What really matters is discipleship. And that's kind of nice and pragmatic, and at a local level it works really well. This is a recent baptismal service in my church in St Andrews, well, in the North Sea, somewhere outside of my church in St Andrews. You'll notice the two people conducting the baptism have the sense to put on wetsuits. The woman being baptised, Becky, grew up Anglican. She was baptised as a baby. She arrived at our church as a student, then stayed on as a paid member of staff on the leadership team after she graduated. 18 months into her time as a staff member on our church, she requested the leader's baptism. In that story, you see both a bit of Baptist sectarianism. Although she'd been baptised as an infant, we very cheerfully tried to drown her in the North Sea. And some Baptist carelessness. We took her on as a paid member of our leadership team, although on the practice of baptism, at least at that point, she disagreed with where the church stood, and in the eyes of the church constitution, she was unbaptised. That story would be really, really easy to repeat all round British Baptist churches. And as I say, that the way that it gets coped with is by saying, well, baptismal status doesn't matter. And when it's Becky coming from Anglican backgrounds, that can seem really nice and ecumenical. We'll take someone, although she's been baptised as an infant, and we're somehow recognising that. But actually, that's not what's going on at all. Had Becky grown up Quaker, the same story would have happened. And we'd have taken someone onto our leadership team who was not baptised at all. Baptists, quite bizarrely, seem to be the only mainline denomination who are prepared to have church officers who are on anyone's account unbaptised. We say it really doesn't matter. Now, I love the ecumenical openness of this, but the theology doesn't make me feel good. Baptism is more important than that. And there are other traditions across in the States, in the British Isles, in Ireland, where there's a much narrower vision of this, where an insistence on proper baptismal practice will be hugely important. In the States, there is a particular tradition of of insisting that there is a kind of unbroken line of apostolic succession, believers baptized by immersion, by believers who were baptized by immersion, by believers who were baptized by immersion, back to the apostles who were believers who were baptized by immersion. There's a wonderful 19th century hymn that doesn't get sung much anymore. Not on the banks of Jordan, but in that flowing stream, stood John the Baptist preacher when he baptized him. John was a Baptist preacher when he immersed the Lamb, so Jesus was a Baptist. And thus the Baptist came. Not in our recent hymn books. The thing I particularly love about it is the image that the Baptist church was already there when Jesus came and joined it. let's get our priorities right here. And coming out of that tradition, there would be a very, very strong emphasis on the rightness of baptismal practice, and someone like Becky would not be allowed probably to take communion unless and until she was prepared to undergo believer's baptism. But in the UK, in Britain, as I say, Ireland's slightly different. That's not the way we've done it because of this story of shared ecumenical cooperation. Now, it seems to me that if we think about that as a broad ecumenical, as a kind of broader practice, are we being rigorous or lax about our denominational distinctives? The rigorous tradition is normal for almost all Christian traditions. Back in the day, we all insisted that we were right and that it mattered. Someone like Bunyan was very, very weird in exercising charity. You know, the preface to the ordinal in the Book of Common Prayer begins, "It is evident to all men reading Holy Scripture and other ancient orders that there have been from the time of the apostles three orders of ministry in Christ's church, bishops, priests and deacons." It's evident, it's right. Anyone who doesn't have bishops is wrong, is being disobedient to Scripture. The village I live in, just outside Stanford, is a place called Strathkinnis. There's a wood, a nice wood at the bottom of the village, called Bishop's Wood. The name comes from 1679, when the restored crown in London was trying to impose episcopacy on the Scottish Church, and a group of religious fanatics, rebels, faithful Christians, depends which side you're on. We have monuments that say both. The Covenanters were resisting this because they believed passionately that the only right way to do church was to be Presbyterian. A guy called James Sharp, who in fact is one of my predecessors, teacher of theology in St Andrews, was appointed Archbishop of St Andrews by the Crown. And in that wood, as he was travelling to St Andrews, was set upon by a group of Covenanters and murdered. Or, if you read one of the monuments in town, martyred. The response was to seize six local people from the village who were known to be sympathetic to the Covenanters' cause, although probably, almost certainly, weren't involved in the crime, and for them to be executed. Or again, if you read one of the monuments in the town, martyred. In response, people cared. People cared about these differences. They really, I mean, killing people is pretty extreme, but this is the village I live in. You should see on a Saturday night. But that sort of rigorist approach that said, no, this matters. We cannot wink at differences over church order, used to be normal for all of us. And if we've become less rigorous, at least in our informal ecumenism, then, you know, that's been a shift from where we once were. The two guys baptising Becky there, one of them, the guy on the right, Al, is one of our pastors at our church. The other one, Kenny, at the time this happened, was on the leadership team of a Presbyterian church in town. And really had no business taking part in the service of rebaptism, but he'd been, he and his wife had been good friends and mentors to Becky as she found her way into church leadership. And so, as an act of recognition of her Christian journey, of friendship, he agreed to do this thing that, that by the rules of his church he probably really shouldn't have done. Much of our informal ecumenism these days is like this, relatively careless of theological distinctives. Bunyan was merely ahead of his time. And whilst we can and should, I think, rejoice in the willingness to cooperate and in the charity that places Christian friendship, shared Christian experience above conformity to rules, I think we should also mourn slightly for the lack of concern for consistent Christian practice. One of the reasons that I wanted to say yes when Ruth invited me to come and speak here, although I looked at the diary and thought, Texas. Texas was warm. that I really value the work that folk like you do. Working to so often try to catch up the structures to the informal realities on the ground, to make real or to make formal those things that people are running ahead of in their enthusiasm for shared working together is really, really important work, and often very hard and very thankless work. And so, you know, as somebody who's fundamentally a local church leader, I'm really grateful to what you do there. And that gets us to, well, if we're not going to be just careless about differences over baptism, are there ways in which we might do this work of recognising the shared Christian life, but working at our understandings of what it is that we do at the beginning of someone's Christian journey, that might help us to get over some of the real theological differences that I've been outlining. Let me take you to a perhaps surprising place, one of the early bilateral dialogues between the Roman Catholic Church and the Ecumenical Patriarchy. It's Barry in 1987, if you're desperately interested, you can find it on the web. Have you all seen that absolutely marvellous YouTube clip that does the rounds of the Ecumenical Patriarchy getting into a car?
That's not the Ecumenical Patriarchy.
I'm sorry. I was misled. So this is Patriarch
Kirill
of Moscow. I'm sorry, yes. Okay. Ignore the picture. This was just a little test to see if anyone could wait. Have you all seen that marvellous YouTube clip that was about the Patriarch Kirill of Moscow getting into a car, and he's got his, I don't know what the right name is, it's probably something ecclesiastical, but he looks like his minder in a suit, who as he gets into the car folds the cross on the top of his headpiece down, because it's on a hinge, because it doesn't fit, and it's a lovely little piece. Anyway, nothing to do with these two, but there was there was an ecumenical bilateral at Barry in 87 between Rome and the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, and baptism was on the agenda. And the document identifies real differences. There's a couple that are mentioned in particular, that Rome allows deacons to be the Orthodox ministers of the sacrament, whilst Constantinople doesn't, and document noted that whilst both communions agree that immersion is kind of normative as a practice of baptism, in actual practice for Rome, effusion is normal, whereas Eastern Orthodox churches still practice immersion. But the thing that they really focused on was the fact that the Orthodox liturgy of baptism includes chrismation and indeed First Eucharist in a single, what they called, complex rite. Whereas Roman Catholic practice has separated confirmation, which the dialogue saw as pretty equivalent to chrismation, from baptism by a matter of years. And indeed, the formal report noted that whilst officially does Eucharist follows confirmation in Roman practice, actually, practically, increasingly, the first reception of the Eucharist comes before confirmation. And they faced up to this, and they suggested that there may be a way through it by thinking not specifically about baptism, but by these three sacramental moments as part of a shared and complex process of initiation. And so we could represent the two traditions a bit like this. For the Orthodox, the three sacraments happen in a group early on in life, whereas the Catholics, baptism happens then with confirmation and officially first Eucharist coming together later. Now, once you look at it like that, there's an obvious parallel. The same journey is being undertaken in the same order. There's kind of a lengthy pause for breath in the journey on one side that isn't there on the other. But you can see how they were able to represent these processes of initiation as very similar processes. And so to say that maybe there's space for convergence, for joint recognition here, that is interesting and serious. Now, we can add in other processes, for instance, catechesis, which clearly occurs in preparation for confirmation.